Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the swan song of Masonic Companion and the initial production of Radio Freemason. This has been a long time in the development, and it will demonstrate, I think, a similar but slightly different format than what we've been doing in the past. I welcome you all. This is the 13th of July, 2014 edition, day 194 of this year. We're in the 28th week already. And as I look out the window, I see summer rain. It's beautiful. It's early here. And you may be picking this up in the middle of the night or late in the evening or wherever you can find a comfortable place to sit and hopefully you kick back with a beverage in your hand and get into an atmosphere for some discussion about Freemasonry. Not the kind of conversation that is commonplace. And as one past notable said recently, that the only time he gave me the hint that the only time people come near is when they want to have a, as he said, philosophical discussion. I guess that's it. The only point of this is a bit of a discussion about things that have a bit of merit in Freemasonry. Not to say it's the bee's knees. There's far more. But every so often we like to have talk about some of the serious ideas, some of the things that don't go on in Lodge, and we seem to struggle and scratch the surface, but don't get into the enriched material that it was promised in the history of the order, the things that drew us to the craft. So today I'm made mention of chemical Freemasonry, just to give us a little bit of a sense of where we're going with that. I want you to need a little musical interlude. Thank you. that does it. That doesn't. Little Edvard Grieg, Hall of the Mountain King. Most people have a belief they are complete. The full package. Strengths, shortcomings, all intractable. It would be difficult to improve if the form was so rigid. How would we make any change? This complete belief denies the fact that human being is adaptive. Man likes habit. In that sense, life is a process influenced as much by our attitudes as by the events and circumstance we face each day. Can most Freemasons see their personal goals that will take them to the objective of insight and self-improvement? Human beings are in an unassailable state of change. We are looking for the bigger man and seeking to be the bigger man. Behavior of a Freemason toward his brethren, family, co-workers, God, and country reveals his state of mind. A Freemason is given an opportunity to hone some useful skills of observation, but to understand them, he must first discover them. Just as he discovered how to balance his bicycle and enjoy the ride, Freemasonry requires a desire to learn and action and a goal. What can you do once you have the skill? Is Freemasonry about having a membership card, wearing regalia, and performing ritual? If it is, then we have stripped Freemasonry of unique history, an enriched philosophy, and philanthropic ethos. Can a man find an ethical right life through Freemasonry? Yeah, with commitment, dedication, opportunity, and sincere mentoring, he may always be in a state of incompletion, but closing in on his goals. How we are known by others should matter. So learn the meaning of hubris, what the arts can express about human condition, how a balanced life is different, and why a satisfactory life does not come from a recipe. A life unexamined is not worth living. Yeah. Stuff happens, eh? I want to talk to you a little bit and just about, go back and a little bit about our history. This is only just to put some context on what's going on around us today. Is that okay? This is from notes of a proceeding done at Fort William in Port Arthur and returns from lodges as of the 31st of December, 1925, before most of us were born. This notes show that there were 107,676 of us. 107,600, so we could round that up to 108,000. It's interesting, isn't it? We seem to have, there were 555 lodges in existence in that time. We had been growing. We had a net growth of over 1,000 Masons in the province of Ontario. And that was 1925, 107,000. Now, today, what are we? Well, let's just say we are, our membership is dropping. Now, let's examine for a moment the question of an aging population. Rightfully, the population today is reaching a point where there will be more older people over the age of 65 soon than under the age of 65. Now, why is this important? Well, the birth rate hasn't outstripped the decline, the death rate. And there's been different reasons for that. Some of them are economical reasons. It's the expense and the challenges of larger families. it's almost laughable when we say, well, today women are in the workforce. Well, today was, what, 40 or 50 years ago. Women have always been in the workforce. They were just not being recognized, not being paid for their slavish lifestyles. And this goes back to Greek times. So there's nothing noble about us laying claim, or absolutely nothing noble about the subjugation of women. That's just odd, because today we can examine matters on a global scale, and this is something that makes us sit up and pay attention. So it's something going on culturally, economically. Well, in the day, 1925, remember, the First World War finished, and resettlements occurred in 1919. But there have been conflicts in the world back to Victorian times, civil wars and economic challenges, and this that had not stopped. The wars became much more mechanized, and the nobility of war was lost. You know, the challenge that even the romantic notions of war were replaced with carnage, a capacity to do more damage. In that first war, the sad part of the history of courage for Canada was withstanding chemical and gas attacks in the trenches. So the men were still, the population was gaining, the membership in Freemasonry was gaining, and it may well have been that when we think about it, communication had expanded, and rightfully so, there was an elite, in particular in Canada, as there is today. Not necessarily the landed gentry, although we have pretenders to that, people that will clamor for that level of recognition. Now, we can be kind and say all people like to be recognized and to be made feel special. We get everything from, and we do that regionally, you know, Maritimers are quite proud, and the Westerners, and people in British Columbia, and people in Quebec are quite proud. Not so defined here in Ontario, which has become sort of that more the cosmopolitan heart of Canada. Not the only area, but certainly. Culture is Canadian culture is still predominant in Ontario, but it's been battered by economics and politics in a way that hasn't happened in other parts of Canada. Not to say that they haven't been battered, but can we truthfully and easily compare what's going on today when we are short quite a bit? We've lost more than half of our membership has declined. So one argument might be, one way of thinking about this, is that we overgrew. We grew fast and lodges were opening all over the place, infrastructure was building up. Maybe we overgrew. And I can't think of a better analogy. You know, the troops that advance, and then they get cut off. Well, we have some historical examples of that, because their logistics to support those troops have to be in place. And if you rush your front lines too far away and cannot support them, then they get cut off. They starve. They run out of fuel and armaments. So it's the notion that if you build something, you have to have a capacity to support it. Perhaps... in our zeal, you know, fitting our mandate of growth and welcome, we overbuilt. Even today, we don't seem to have, we have this idea that we should be closing the doors, and we hear different leaders talking about that, but we don't have the mechanics to do it. Close the doors and develop, you know, put a cap on the membership of a lodge. one lodge that we know of in Ontario has a cap of 65 members. And when it reaches that, that's cut off. And all the expenses are shared by those 65. And that's a different kind of commitment than the fast growth, large growth, that volume, it defines success model. The degree mills have been unleashed and compete quite happily, completely unaware of this other context that's missing in those lodge functions. So we build lodges that are too big. Did we build too many? Did we have 555 lodges, and were they too many? I put that out there. And our membership did go up from the period of 1925. You know, it continued to grow into the 50s and 60s, and then it started to crest. So there was a lot of inertia, a lot of energy behind that growth. And let's say there were 30 or 40 years of energy behind that growth, and let's say it would take another 30 or 40 years for that energy to dissipate. You know, just looking at a rough logic here. So let's say if the pinnacle was in the 60s, add 40 or 50 years to that, and it takes us up to where we are today, where the growth has faded gradually. The energy that you know, like this, think of the steam engine. The energy has faded gradually. And this is happening in other jurisdictions. This is not unique to the one that I'm sitting in right here, Masonic jurisdictions. And that the settling will show us, you know, the flakes of gold in the bottom of the pan, so to speak. It's a phenomenon that we don't seem to be able to arrest. We've tried a few things, but essentially they've amounted to doing more of the same. We do like habit, and we struggle with that. It tends to make us uncomfortable around innovation. And yet, without innovation, our capacity to our ability to protect what we have and move forward is going to be challenged. Moving forward, the numbers we know we can't protect. Having appeal to people, we seem to be doing the same thing we've done for many, many years. The degree mills are very, very active. And what was that notion that we had parrot masons? People that can say things but have no real understanding what it is they're talking about. It seems, how do we describe that without it being an insult? But who are we insulting? The goods, we could say the goods aren't being delivered. We could say then maybe the expectations are beyond our capacity to deliver, in which case we would want to either develop the capacity or change the expectations. Well, we haven't done either. We still have those lofty expectations because that's the appeal, that's the branding that brings people to our door, that curiosity. As this happens, our history is changing. Our history wasn't the history today. Isn't the history of 40 years ago. How do we define what's been going on in the past 40 years without sounding uninformed? And unaware. It's hard to suggest that we can be positive and become cheerleaders, but it's also hard to walk away from a challenge. What is the challenge that's going to galvanize us? Is it? I don't think it's the numbers. I don't think it's a membership that challenges us. I think if Freemasonry has always gone through been redefined according to the contemporary setting. It has an adaptive quality. Perhaps we are clinging to something that never really existed. It happens when we see people coming from, you know, when we see people, it's a phenomenon that the sociologists have known for quite some time. In nations, culture changes and always has. But when you leave that culture and come to another place, that picture, the last picture that you have in your mind of that culture is somehow what we want to preserve. We don't see the evolution that's occurred in the meantime. We see that snapshot. And so we struggle. So in fact, we've heard people, you know, you'll often hear planners and developers and commenters about Scotland saying, Canada, there's more tartan worn in Canada than there is in Scotland. Italians here in Canada carry on more of the Italian tradition than occurs in Italy. It's an odd kind of a comment. And are these things defining everybody? Well, of course not. Of course not. It's just out there. And what does it reveal? Well, maybe we've, you know, when Freemasonry crossed the ocean, what we had was a snapshot of expectations that went on to be affected by reality in Britain and Europe, but that change that was occurring, a day-by-day domestic effects, didn't happen here in this jurisdiction. And we have a struggle, to preserve an image that perhaps never existed in the first place and certainly doesn't exist today. The question being, is it working? Well, I think this process, this uncomfortableness, this threat, this anxiety that we have about the order, these navel-gazing, you know, pondering, is a necessary event, that it was inevitable that in the progress and aging of Masonic order, you can ask this about yourself and your own Masonic order, these pressures are neither good or bad. They just are what they are. And you think of it more on a universal landscape. They are what they are. The sun at the corona, a million degrees centigrade. The surface, 55,000 degrees centigrade. What's that tell us? Well, it is what it is. These forces, these changes that are going on, will require, whether we are motivated to do it or whether we think that this is all something that's controllable, is humbling. These are forces that are out of our control. We can sit back and watch and witness and learn. Can we stop them from coming? Apparently not. Can we shape the outcomes? I think so. But as we move forward, as our history continues to be revealed, we're living history today that will be revealed in the future, we're going to have to make sense of this. Hindsight will give us a more accurate view of what's happened over the past 40 years than what we're able to have today. But this shrinkage is happening for reasons that we only partially understand. And while we may not, it may be unfamiliar to us, that it will change our habits. Can we anticipate and stay ahead of this? Yeah, if we choose to. And we probably should, to my estimation, stay ahead of it. And optimize the opportunity. Now, there's an economy of scale. As we're smaller, we're able to do things differently. We aren't as ponderous. Doesn't take as long. Is it time for us to re-examine our connection with the principles and landmarks? Right now, we're seeing that that's already happened. I think that we have the Renaissance underway. And if you'll allow, we hear education being brought up repeatedly. Not as one definitive statement, one statement of fact about education, but a question, a willingness to attempt education at different levels, in different places, at different times. We aren't quite yet ready for the discussions of scholarship. We have some areas are closer to that discussion than others. The idea that that growth in Freemasonry happens with uniformity, I think, needs to be re-examined. Growth happens in unique areas first. And as growth is occurring in one area, the seasons are passing and there's a drop-off in other areas. In balance, we may be that we are shrinking, not downsizing, because that makes it seem as if some hand is at play. This isn't downsizing. This is change. Erosion is probably a better term. And it's not something that's recoverable. We can't tell whether we can sustain large numbers with the way we've been nurturing Freemasonry up to this point. We've had great fun. It's been a great ride, building a lodge and the excitement of constructing a room and getting the proper furniture, hanging out your shingles, so to speak, and getting together with good fellows and going through a procedure where that has the formal presence of approvals. It's nobody has a right to Freemasonry. You're approved. You're brought in by people that are already in there. Well, that's become a bit of a red herring. We no longer, it doesn't really have that much value because we're afraid to what that might do to the harmony of a lodge, even though not taking that step if can affect the gene pool in a lodge. You know, we want to, hopefully the young men that are entering my lodge tomorrow are going to be brighter, more successful and capable, more curious than me. And the Masons coming behind them will be more capable, have greater potential than them. Hopefully we will always be like that. We'll be bringing in our replacements. But with each replacement, we need to be able to look at them as our own children. Hopefully they'll stand on our shoulders and we'll be better educated and more capable and more successful than us. And we would want that for our lodge, to be able to ensure that the qualities of our Masonic presence are going to be carried on, passed on from generation to generation. it's hard, easier said than done, because it's hard to stop erosion unless we have more people with that keen education that are able to bring their perspective to the table and carry on the education. The clamor usually goes sideways because when, especially when Masonic principles have been rejected by a man, you know, it's like you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. There's a clamor for correctness, a competition, which is all too familiar in the profane world. So some of these things we've allowed to occur in Lodge, because it's a bit stunning to figure out what to do about these things. When we see things that are un-Masonic happening in a lodge, it gives us choices. We can tolerate it, pretend it doesn't exist, which is probably the biggest, makes us makes us hypocritical if we've taken obligations. Bad manners makes us a bit hypocritical of our obligations to one another. But so is expecting so much that we're just a rigid, uncomfortable, unpleasant experience. So we have to relax. We have to go into our lodges with a bit of give and take. And keep that mindset in view so that we roll with whatever happens, but that we find a degree of tolerance. Remember that the principles of Freemasonry are not exercised until a Freemason has absolutely no reason to change. He knows in his mind that he is absolutely right in his thinking, in his judgment. He's absolutely correct, but can also realize for the sake of his lodge and the harmony, he needs to suck it up, buttercup. He needs to rely heavily on the principles of Freemasonry to carry him through those painful episodes that other men cannot. Other untrained individuals cannot do that. They'll react emotionally and will feel valid. So the questions that we pose to each other, is it possible to be absolutely right and absolutely wrong at the same moment? When you have no reason to change your mind or to tolerate, and yet you do, then you are experiencing the effect of Masonic principles, the landmarks. It's confusing at the start. It's crazy making. It's knowing that you're right and yet withholding that. The behavior and manner of other people around you will be clear. If you read between the lines of the ritual, this is what's being told. Think of it as easy as Hiram. He was mistaken in his judgment of the fellow craft that he thought he could trust. So remember, they turned. They did some unspeakable things. They conspired. So he had been duped. He had been trusting. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can imagine the way we would feel when we learned that people that we had assumed could be trusted aren't trustworthy. The message of the confrontations by the three that led to his death. And do you learn from the insight? Well, the world isn't going to become pastels It doesn't soften or harden. It's serious. But can you extract joy and satisfaction without seeming frivolous, without being mawkish? Insight. What is that balance point where we can be carefree and enjoy the freedom of our insight? And when that happens, we are influencing the behavior and thinking of others. So what do you do when people around you are rash? What does the Masonic principles tell you or talk to you about? And what meaning do you take from them? I had a couple of fellows talking to me about truth. I just speak my mind, as they say, and then they feel vindicated in a way, validated, when people around them react. Well, I have to think, where is insensitivity an aspect of truth? Just because, of course, when people tell me that they just speak the truth or what, I presume they're guessing. People have no way of determining what is the truth. History, time teaches us that. We have impressions. We have opinions, but so do other people. I say things the way I see them. Really? Well, who cares? Everybody has that going on. So it's not to be guarded. It's to be thoughtful in our footsteps. I think of it like walking through the woods where we want to discover things in the natural state. Well, we're not going to do it strapped to a machine, crashing noisily through the underbrush. If you've ever walked through the woods in moccasin, you know, or barefoot, you know when you're looking, or the conservationists around us, the hunters will know that you, or the artists with cameras, you walk as if you're part of the nature so that you don't startle things. You're beginning to fit in so that you see something in its natural state so that you can observe it. If you can't show that patience, then you don't make those observations. It requires a bit of patience, but it also requires a desire and a feeling that it's something that can be learned. So can you do that for your own sake? Not intrusively, but to make observations. 1925 was not that long ago. I think that my grandfather, Cyril, would have been born then. And even as I was a little boy, he was teaching me things of Masonic principle. Even at the time, though, I had no idea. No idea. It's taken many, many decades for me to realize, for the penny to drop, and realize where I first was taught that lesson. It was important for him that I knew about hypocrisy. And then it takes a lifetime to figure out what that lesson means. Let's charge on here. This is the first episode of Radio Freemason. I'm going to talk about the Illuminati. We have inherited some things, boys. We have inherited a very interesting history. Some of it conjecture, but very, very interesting. Some of it we can be very, most of it, I think, we can feel it comes to us with a great deal of satisfaction. Some of it, we want to disavow. I doubt that most of the people that I sit in the lodge with would have any sense of being part of a nefarious group. I'm going to talk about our history and historical connection with one of those groups. We distort history and make legends out of it. And those legends and mythologies convey very important lessons. So the literalists in the room that like to take the world in a literal sense will perhaps have some difficulty with me, because we're going to try and examine as much of the science as we possibly can so that we understand. If we want to learn from the legends of Freemasonry, I don't find anything necessarily wrong with that. If somebody was to presume that the legends are in fact part of the living history, I would have difficulty with that. Let me talk to you about the Illuminati. This is the kind of stuff that the profane world finds in reasoning through why Freemasonry is unhealthy, because it does things clandestine, and the proof of it comes from we trace a lot of it to Taxil's work in the 19th century that claimed to be manipulating Freemasonry into position for the Vatican to attack so he could mock the Vatican. Like, I'm not so sure the guy was that bright or just an opportunist, but his workings, which he admitted in court, was just made up. His disclosures about Freemasonry that he admitted had no basis in fact, sold books. He was making money, and he knew the salacious story always would sell. And then he used the whole scene. But what do we want to remember? And what does the public want to remember? They're not going to scrape the surface and find out these little known or little admitted truths that this guy was a scoundrel. Maybe it makes better theater if we take it all as fact that it says that we are engaging in practices unhealthy, than to say, we're vulnerable to the charlatans, and we're vulnerable to the manipulations of people who have their own agenda, their own politics. And they want to build and take some advantage at the expense of Freemasons. And if we add an emotional voice, then that's as if it gives credibility to the criticism, when in fact all it is somebody that doesn't have enough control over their emotion. Freemasonry in Prussia, Bavaria, and Austria was almost as confusing as it was in France for many of the same reasons. Lots of competing orders and rites were invented, having little or nothing to do with the original notions of English craft, Freemasonry. Over in Bavaria, a professor of religious law named Adam Weishaupt had a great idea. In 1776, he formed a group called the Order of Perfectibilists, with the notion that through mutual aid, philosophical discussions, and careful advice, it would improve morality and virtue and oppose evil, improve society, and thus reform the world. It sounded Masonic, and in fact, Weishaupt cribbed some of his ceremonies from Masonic ritual. Weishaupt was an intellectual. He was born a Jew, baptized as a Catholic, and educated by Jesuits. Now he was looking for new recruits for his group, so he joined a Masonic lodge in 1777. Through his lodge, he interested several fellow Masons who fancied themselves intellectuals. And then they quickly changed the name of the new order to Illuminati, meaning intellectually inspired. At first, he convinced only four others to join him, and they adopted secret names and codes to communicate with each other. Weishaupt, in particular, had to keep his role a secret because he was making his living as a Catholic canon law professor at a Catholic university. Under the pen name Spartacus, Weishaupt outlined a secret plan to infiltrate the Freemasons, overthrow the governments of nations and churches, take over the world and create a new world order of tolerance and equality. What is it about Germany and little guys wanting to rule the world? In a short time, the Illuminati grew to about 2,000 members. They expanded into Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Poland, Hungary, Italy, and of course France. A friend of Weishaupt's, Baron Adolf King, was a well-known Mason in Bavaria and assisted Weishaupt with developing degree rituals based on Masonic ceremonies. Unfortunately, the Illuminati attracted both the best and the worst of aristocratic society, and its aims began to lead far more to the destroy governments and churches side than to the improve society side. And Baron Knigg finally had enough. The fight between the men created a split between the sides. At the same time, his Catholic students at the University of Ingolstadt were being increasingly pumped full of his anti-Catholic rhetoric. The Jesuits figured out just who Spartacus was and outed him. As the confessors to the royalty of Europe, they had their own network of spies and infiltrators, and they convinced the Bavarian government to arrest him in 1784. He fled the country, but left behind his incriminating papers, outlining the Illuminati's ambitious, if bizarre, plans for world domination. They were widely published all over Europe to expose the Illuminati's secret plans, and to flush out other members, many of whom wound up in prison. The Illuminati never was popular, and the movement died out completely by the end of the century. It was a tiny, insignificant, and largely ridiculous group that had no effect on any society in which it existed. Yet today, conspiracy theorists believe it still survives as the secret controlling force in Freemasonry, and that it is continuing its evil plans for world domination. Ha ha! We've often suspected that. Ridiculous. You see how conjecture can be so powerful and cause so much damage. And waste is the natural mind fearful, and is that our natural state? There's I think not. Conspirators are a bit like puppies. They chase their own tail. They have great fun doing it. I have difficulty I think the conspiracists' mind. It's like when I'm reading about the cabal and numerology and the proofs that these sequence of numbers prove something intellectual and metaphysical. I have difficulty because I'm thinking in nature, I can see mathematical progression. You know, I can find those calculations, but are they actually causal? Do they actually cause or speak about relationships? I tend not to think so. I think that we can find those. If we look long enough, we'll find things that seem to show patterns. But we can make the mistake of saying that one causes the other or one is an outcome of the other. Perhaps they just exist in that orbit. It's been great. I'm going to come back to you in a week. I'm off to the annual communication. It should be interesting. This is my swan song as a Grand Lodge officer right now, but no. And I'm happy to pass the mantle on to the next one that we elect. We have a little bit of Rachmaninoff to see us out the door. And I look forward to seeing you all again soon. In the meantime, may the great architect of the universe be very kind to you and yours. Thank you. That was Rachmaninoff playing his own piece, Prelude in C. I think you'll enjoy it. I'll see you later. And in the meantime, here's a little send-off from Tongue-in-Cheek World. You know, what better place to do it than to say goodbye than with a little of this.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life. Always look on the right side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Where things happen to you, huh?
Available in the foyer.
Come with us. What do you think pays for this?